This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Former child actor Macaulay Culkin, star of the Home Alone movie series, has spent the last few years reinventing himself on film. In the fact-based movie Party Monster, he starred as a flamboyant, ultimately homicidal New York club kid. In Saved, he played a wheelchair-bound high school student. And in this continuing exercise in personal redefinition, Macaulay Culkin has just written a book. It's called Junior, and is described by the publisher as part fictional memoir, part rant, and part postmodern gamesmanship. Macaulay Culkin's most recent movie, the comedy Saved, is set in a Christian high school named American Eagle. It was produced by Michael Stipe's company, Single Cell. The story revolves around the girls in the school's Christian rock band. Jenna Malone plays a girl who tries to save her boyfriend's soul by helping him prove he's not really gay. Unfortunately, in the process, she becomes pregnant. Mandy Moore plays the school's most preachy Christian, and Macaulay Culkin plays her skeptical brother. As a result of a childhood accident, he needs a wheelchair to get around. He becomes close with the school rebel, who is also the school's only Jewish student, played by Eva Amuri. In this scene, Culkin and Amuri are talking at an outdoor cafe just across the street from the Planned Parenthood office.
What's the matter? I'm scared to be seen in public with a stripper.
No, I'm scared of being seen with a cripple.
I've been seen with worse.
Hillary Faye's gonna freak out when I'm out there waiting for her.
Who cares?
It's just that I don't get out much on my own.
I'm not really a stripper, you know.
I'm not really a Christian. So, how'd you end up at American Eagle? I mean, you're Jewish, right?
Well, after I got expelled from my last school, it was either here or homeschooling. I figure I could handle these freaks better than my parents.
Well, lucky me.
Are you playing footsies with me?
Wheelies.
Hey, isn't that...
Mary? What is she doing downtown?
Well, there's only one reason Christian girls come down to the Planned Parenthood.
She's planning a pipe bomb?
Okay, two reasons.
When the film was released in 2004, Terry asked Macaulay Culkin why he wanted to be part of the film Saved.
I mean, it was just such a smart movie. It was just so smart and funny, and I just loved how it approached issues, and I loved just the structure of it. I love the fact that it kind of, you know, all these characters start off as these kind of, you know, almost cliches or caricatures almost of teen movies or of Christianity even. I love how they kind of break down or are torn down throughout the course of the film, and it kind of exposed for what they really are. And I just love the subject matter. I mean, I'm not a very, very religious person, but at the same time, I was one of those people who was, I was raised Catholic, which means I'm an ex-Catholic. But, you know, went to Catholic school, you know, math, English, Jesus Christ. It's kind of a part of the curriculum. And so, you know, which is something that's, you know, I've always found interesting. So, yeah, just wanted to be a part of it.
What did you relate to about the character that you play in Saved?
Well, I love, you know, he was very cynical. Because he, you know, he's in a wheelchair in the movie. And his older sister, or actually younger sister, Hillary Faye, played by Mandy Moore, is always kind of wheeling him around like he's some sort of merit badge. Like, you know, look how good of a Christian I am. I take care of my brother who's in a wheelchair. And it kind of exposes him to the manipulative aspects of religion, of Christianity. And so he rejects it, basically. And I think by the end, he kind of comes full circle. And he eventually kind of ends up finding how he's right with Jesus, basically, and finding his religion.
Well, I have to say, I think you've made such really interesting and, in a way, daring choices in the movies that you've decided to make as an adult.
You.
You know, you took like a hiatus of, I don't know, 8 or 9 years away from
like
acting.
That, yeah.
Then you did a play on the West End in London.
Mm-hmm.
And then your reemergence in movies was Party Monster, in which you played a gay, drug-addicted club kid who becomes so addled he murders his drug dealer. Let me play a short clip from the movie, and this comes from early in the film when you're doing a voiceover narration telling the viewers about the story of your life. And your narration intersects a little bit with your mother's description of your childhood.
Hi, I'm Michael. I grew up in the Midwest. Usual story, felt different, really didn't fit in. But I wasn't going to turn the other cheek. No, sirree. I started selling candy in school. Jacked up the prices several 100%.
This is my Michael. He was always making money. He had a knack for it.
Yeah.
My little candy man.
Let's see. What else? Oh, once when I was 10, my Sunday school teacher took me back to his house. He taught me how to French kiss, among other things.
He really took my boy under his wing. Very nice man.
His mother caught us in the basement and she screamed, "I told you not to bring them here." And he said, "Don't, you'll frighten them away."
One night, Michael gave me a goodnight kiss. That a little boy should not give his mother.
I thought everyone kissed like that.
Now, you look and sound so different in this movie than, say, in your child movie era. I'm interested in that kind of voice that you got for the film.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, because we were playing real people. We kind of really tried to stay true to who they were. I mean, there's kind of certain rules that apply to playing a character like that. Because you want to try your best to talk like them. You want to try your best to move like them and things like that. And these people were very, very specific about the way they talked and the way that they just kind of move their arms and things. And so we kind of had to play within those rules, basically. But, yeah, me and Seth just went out there, and I remember when he first signed on to it, because we kind of talked about doing this, and we kind of had a plan about how we're going to prepare and how we're going to just do all these things. And
this is Seth Green, you're a co-star.
Seth Green, my co-star. And so, yeah, he calls me up on the phone. He goes, "Hi, you know, hi, Michael, it's James. You know, I was in New York, but I'm sorry I missed you, and blah, 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 blah." You know, he kind of just leaves you this message in like a dead-on James St. James impression. I couldn't believe it. Actually, I listened to it on the phone and replayed the tape, and I couldn't believe it. And I was like, gosh, I got to get on my game, too. So I started kind of messing around with the voice and basically playing repeat-after-me games with the VCR and, you know, any kind of footage I can get of him. And went to a voice person to kind of just literally kind of almost phonetically write out some of the stuff. But, you know, just talk like Michael, you know. Oh, James, and I called him up. I'm like, "James, I'm sorry I missed you when you were in town. You crazy," you know, just like sending all these weird, you know, like voice messages to each other. It was fun, you know. And we really just wanted, like I said, we wanted to talk like them and move like them as much as possible, but at the same time, not make caricatures of them. And at the same time, you wanted enough creative freedom within the characters to maneuver and do kind of whatever you felt was appropriate for storytelling. So it's a fine line you tread, but I think we pulled it off all right.
One of the things I found really interesting about your portrayal of Michael Alec in Party Monster is that in one respect, he's the opposite of you. And here's what I mean. You become a star at the age of, what, 8 or something? 10?
Yeah, basically.
You know, in Home Alone. And by the time you were 14, you wanted out of that whole star-making machinery stuff. You wanted to stop acting and you wanted out of show business, at least for a while. And whereas he comes to New York and he wants to be a star. I mean, he is living to be famous. He is living to be seen.
No, he spent his entire life running towards fame, and I spent half my life running away from it.
Well, as someone who was a star as a child and who wanted to leave that whole thing, did you understand what being famous, what being a star would mean to somebody like Michael Alec? Did you understand what it meant to be desperate or why somebody would want it?
It's interesting because I truly don't understand fame. I kind of just accept it. You know, I've been doing this, you know, I've been doing this since I was 4 years old, and it's just, you know, it's 19 years now. And, you know, for a while there, you know, from when I was about 8 years old on, I was playing the game at a pretty high level overall. And so, I don't know. It wasn't like I was consciously saying to myself, "Ah, gosh, I want to be famous." You know, it was just kind of like I had a lot of energy and I enjoyed the attention that came with being on stage. And it wasn't about the attention that came, not all the other attention, like, you know, photographers hiding in your bushes. You know, I could definitely do without that and could have done even when I was 8 years old without that. Like I said, fame had nothing to do with it with me. So it was kind of fun to get in there and kind of just, you know, why would he want that? Where does this come from? You know, it's coming from this kind of, this almost need to fit in almost. And he kind of took it to this hyper reality, basically, and created his own world where he was famous, you know. And because in that world, you have to understand, back in the club days, back in, like, you know, after Andy Warhol basically passed on, the club scene was basically dead. Before, you go to these clubs and like, oh, look, there's Liza Minnelli. Oh, look over there, there's Cher, you know, and that was kind of the way it was. But now they were all gone. All these kind of club idols were gone. And so Michael kind of swept in and created these celebrities, basically. Basically just said, I'm famous because I say so. And I have absolutely no substance to me whatsoever, but that doesn't matter because I'm famous. And it's just this weird concept that, you know, the celebrity without a cause kind of thing, you know, just like, you know, famous because I say so. And you have to understand that all these people were coming from this world, like this high school world, basically, where, you know, insiders and outsiders, and they were definitely the outsiders. They were homosexuals. They didn't dress right. They didn't look right. There was a lot of things wrong with them. And so then now they come to New York City and they're the kings of the clubs. Now, all the people, all those like people who played high school football and all those people who were really cool in high school were now standing outside of their clubs wanting to get into their world. And they were kind of turned the tables in the entire world and said, you know what? No, you're not in. You're not allowed into our little world. And it was interesting. It was kind of more coming from that than almost a need to be like, you know, famous and on the cover of magazines. It was more kind of just turning the tables on the entire world.
Macaulay Culkin speaking to Terry Gross. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2004 interview with actor and now author Macaulay Culkin. His first book, Junior, was published earlier this month.
What are some of the differences for you between acting as a child and acting now as an adult?
It was interesting. I mean, when I was younger, it was just more about, I had a lot of energy, and like I said, I enjoyed attention, or at least the good kind of attention that came with being on stage. And that was really all it came from. And they kind of, a lot of the things I did when I was younger was literally just kind of when you're a child actor, the most important thing is you have to know your lines. It's amazing. Like, that's all they really care about when they're casting a kid, is know your lines. And so my father, you know, for everything that he was still a very clever man. And so one of the things he did for the audition process was, they'd send me the script and they'd say, oh, do scene 22 and scene 12 or whatever. And they're very, very short, simple scenes. So what he'd do is he'd go through the entire script and find the two longest speeches and two longest, hardest scenes and have me memorize. Because I had a pretty good memory and I remembered the whole thing. And so when I got into the room, me being a cute little 9-year-old, they say, hey, can you do scene 12? And I go, oh, wait, but I studied scene 30, you know? And they'll go, oh, it's okay, little kid. Just do what you studied. And then I go out and I reel off this long thing. And the next thing I know, I have the part, you know? And so it was, like I said, it was more about having a lot of energy and learning your lines, basically. Whereas now it's different, you know? It's you definitely can't just do that, you know? And so, no, I try to bring more to my work. I mean, I'm definitely a more experienced human being. And so I just try to bring those kind of things to the table and just try to, you know.
And you get to choose your roles.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, after a while, I mean, I wasn't choosing anything. It was just kind of like, oh, by the way, don't make any plans this summer because you're doing a movie and things like that. So now I'm in a position where I'm making my own choices. I'm putting stuff out there that I want out there, that, you know, and so it's cool. And so I just try to do different kinds of things. And, you know, I just try to do good work. That's all.
You know, it's so easy, I think, to become a praise junkie when you're a kid, you know, if people are praising you a lot.
Yeah, I really wasn't so much. I wasn't, you know, my parents were pretty good overall. Like, they never told me how much money I was making or things like that. All that stuff kind of was news to me. And when I turned 18, I found out how much money I'd made. And
weren't you reading the newspapers? I mean, I knew how much money you were making.
Yeah, but you know what? No one does. That's the thing. People still don't. You should hear the kinds of numbers people throw out. I mean, they're either way too high or way too low.
Oh,
I don't know. There's all kinds of numbers being thrown out there. I don't release my financial records. It's not something that's all that important. I mean, yes, it's important. I'm definitely glad I have the money, but at the same time, it's not like something I don't release my numbers to Forbes magazine or something like that. But yeah, no, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like I was doing it for even the gratification. I was just having a blast. I enjoyed the people on set. You know, I liked working with Chris Columbus. I love the stunt people. They were always my favorite, you know, like I had a good time on set. And so
when did that start to change? When did the good time start to not be?
You know what? I always liked the people on set. I always liked the hair and makeup people. I always liked the wardrobe. They were always really cool people and they always really got it. They understood the position that I was in, really. And so, it wasn't even that. It was just kind of like I needed a break. And I remember I said this to my father, and he kind of just wasn't listening. And the next thing I know, I'm on the next set, and then I started kind of telling anyone who'd listen. But, you know, obviously I was wrong because no one was listening. And it was kind of this crazy thing. And so when my father was out of the picture and I was in a position to say, you know, I don't want to do this anymore, I did. And so I went to whoever was listening or whoever was out there and just said, listen, you can call it retirement. You can call it a break. You can say I quit. It doesn't really matter because it's yours now. It's not mine. You guys can, you know, that Macaulay Culkin public persona is yours. You can do whatever you want with it. I'm going to go to high school, and I'm going to do whatever else from there. But I'm probably never going to act again, and that's it. You know, I hope you made your money because there's no more coming from me.
When you were young and getting paid, you know, millions and millions of dollars for movie roles, did you have a sense of what was riding on you financially, not just your family, but like the director's future, the movie company's future, you know, and all the people working for them? I mean, the movie had to be a success. Your name had to really
hold
up.
I know. There was this weird kind of thing. People were kind of building this odd industry around me, and it was kind of this weird thing. And I mean, I don't know. I mean, I guess they tried their best to shelter me from a lot of that stuff, but at the same time, you can't really hide from that, you know, just the overall pressures of it. But it wasn't anything that, like, made me crack or, you know, shattered me emotionally or something. It was just kind of, it was at a point where I almost didn't know any better. You know, I mean, I understood that other 9-year-olds weren't doing the same things I was, but at the same time, it wasn't like I knew what Little League was like, you know, or what summer camp was like. I mean, this was my life. And so I didn't really know anything else. So, you know, I mean, part of it was like a little too much, and that was one of the things why I got away. But it wasn't something I was consciously saying to myself, you know, like, oh gosh, you know, I really hope we make that, you know, we make that $50 million so the studio will hire me for their next movie. Because at that point, I really didn't care.
You said that your father really pushed you. What are some of the things you think he did wrong in terms of how hard he pushed you or what he pushed you to do?
It's funny, you know, it's one of these things where, I don't know. I mean, people kind of have this weird, you know, this weird thing about me and my father, at least our relationship. They're always kind of like, oh, you know, isn't that sad that, you know, you don't really see your father anymore or anything like that. And it's like, you know, and that everything turned out the way that it did. But what people don't understand was that it was always like this, that, like, you know, he was not a good guy long before we were rich and famous. It was kind of just a part of his personality. And from a very early age, I pretty much knew that, you know, I was, you know, either he was going to be gone or I was going to end up moving out of the house very early. It was one or the other. And I knew that from a very early age, before fame, before money, before anything. And so
what was it that he did that made you realize
that? He just honestly, I wish it was that easy. I wish it was I could point out to one incident or one thing and say that was it. I mean, he was just not a good person. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have to understand. I mean, later on, I mean, it was like, you know, I was making who knows how much money, and I was sleeping on the couch in the living room. Like, I didn't even have a bed. I didn't have a room or a bed. I mean, you should have saw his room, and you should have saw the size of his bed and his television and things like that. And it wasn't about making me, you know, it was kind of more just putting you in your place and making sure that you knew who was in charge of the whole thing. And it's kind of like, and he played those games with you, and he was always playing those games with you. And so, you know, like, you know, even from a very early age, I knew what kind of person he was. And I knew, you know, I watched him very closely. I wanted to make sure how I wasn't with my children and how I did not want to treat my wife and things like that. I mean, I knew that from a very early age. I mean, I remember he was the first person I ever cussed at, ever. I was like 4 years old, and, you know, I forgot what he was doing or what I was doing. But, yeah, I told him to F off. I couldn't believe it, you know, like, wow. I didn't even believe it then. I was like, wow, I was like 3 or 4 years old, and that came out of my mouth. It was just like, but that was our relationship. That was the way it was.
You know, there's so many child stars who just are emotional cripples by the time they reach adulthood. You seem to have, like, emerged okay.
I guess so. I don't know. I mean, I understand that I'm a part of, like, some weird fraternity and some weird kind of convention or you know, group of cliches or whatever. And, you know, I understand that. But at the same time, I don't, you know, I'm aware of it, but I don't fight it.
Are you really okay?
Yes, I'm fine. Don't worry about me. No. No, man, I feel good. I think, you know, and a lot of that had to do with me taking some time off and me getting away from everything, you know. And just I'm a strong person because of it. I know what I want out of life, and I'm not kind of just doing this because I don't know any better. I mean, I see a lot of, you know, not a lot, but, I, you know, there's a good amount of these child actors or former child actors who trying to make that transition into adulthood but never really took the time to live. It never really took the time to exist. And so how do you expect someone to act like a human being when they've never had the chance to be a human being?
Well, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Macaulay Culkin, speaking to Terry Gross in 2004. His book is called Junior, or Oscar de la Mancha, The Wembling Warrior, and The People I Like the Least.